In what sense?
Mr. Baldwin, do you think the revolution is a revolution? How would you elaborate our previous concepts of revolution?
Well, that's a tough one to answer, because I'm not always sure that the word revolution is the right word. I myself use it because I don't know of any other. It's not in my mind, anyway. It's not as simple as a revolution of one class against another, for example. It is not as clear-cut, let us say, as the Algerian Revolution against the French. It is a very peculiar revolution because it has to, in order to succeed at all, it has to have as its aim the reestablishment of the Union. And a radical shift in the in American mores, in the American way of life. Not only as they apply to the Negro, obviously, but as they apply to every citizen of the country. This is a very tall order and desperately dangerous, but inevitable in my view, because of the nature of our history, the nature of the American Negro's relationship to the rest of the country for all these generations, and the attitude the country's had toward him, which is simply now, always was, but now has become overtly and concretely intolerable.
May I interrupt here for one moment? You say different from a revolution like the Algerian, which means liquidation of a class, another country's control.
Well,
of a regime.
Of a regime.
And also, it's not liquidation of a class either.
No.
Something else.
No. Because the Algerians and the French had very great differences, partly simply because the Algerians had a country called Algeria, which happened to be ruled by France. And the aim of the revolution there would have had to be to break the power of the French.
It's an old type of nationalistic revolution, then.
Yes, that's right. But that doesn't apply here at all, because this is, at least in principle, one nation. It's Americans battling to get rid of an invader or to even to destroy a class, but to liberate themselves and their children from what precisely? From the economic and social sanctions imposed on them traditionally because they were slaves here. Now, there's some concrete things involved in this, I think. You know, I think that, for example, if Washington had the energy to move to break the power of people like Senator Eastland and Senator Russell, so the Negroes began to vote in the South, we would have made a large step forward. If Negroes could vote in Mississippi, you would have a different state. If you could get a different state in Mississippi, you could begin to have a different country. I mean, it's not as mystical or as fuzzy as people make it seem. It seems to me that the South is ruled very largely still by an oligarchy which rules for its own benefit and not only oppresses Negroes and murders them, but really imprisons and victimizes the bulk of the white population.
You said once in print that the Southern mob does not represent the will of the Southern majority.
Well, I still feel that. I think that.
How would you discuss that?
Well, those mobs that fill the street, it seems to me, unless one's prepared to say that the South is populated entirely by monsters, which I'm not, those mobs that fill the street are a reflection, I think, of the terror that everybody feels, but this is on the lowest level. And those mobs that fill the street have been used by the American economy for generations to keep the Negro in his place. In fact, they've done the Americans, North and South, by the way, dirty work for him. They've always been encouraged to do it. No one has ever even given them any hint that it was wrong. And, of course, they're now completely bewildered. The mob, yes. And can only react in one way, which is through violence, in the same way that an Alabama sheriff facing a Negro student knows that he's in danger, doesn't know what the danger is, and all he can do is beat him over the head or counterprod him. He doesn't know what else to do.
May I interrupt to make one test here to be sure we are... all revolutions of the ordinary historical type have depended on, say, the driving force of hope and the driving force of hate. They're going somewhere and they are mobilizing the adrenaline against something. I suppose you can put it this way. The other things may be involved with those things. Now, when this is directed against a regime to be liquidated, it's one thing. When it's inside of a system which must be reordered but not destroyed, maybe vastly reordered, then the hope-hate ratio might change. I think how the hate is accommodated in a case like that, this kind of a, quote, revolution.
Well, the American Negro has had to accommodate a vast amount of hatred for since he's been here. And that was a terrible school to go through. I think, though, that it, so far, and in this context, operates to control what hatred, what such hatred as there is. I myself, though I'm accused of hating all white people and saying what all Negroes do, I myself don't feel that so much as I feel a bitterness and a dislike. One's been too involved to hate anybody whom you raised. You can despise him. You know, you can have a great complex of feelings about them, and you may even at given moments want to kill them. But it wouldn't come under the heading for me of the hatred the Algerians felt for the French, which is obviously on one level certainly much much less complicated. A Frenchman is simply a Frenchman. But here it's your brothers and your sisters, whether or not they know that they're your brothers and your sisters. And that complicates it. It complicates it so much that I can't possibly myself quite see my way through this. As for the hope, that is fuzzy too. Hope for what? You know, the best people involved in this revolution certainly don't hope to become what the bulk of Americans have become. So the hope begins then has to be to create a new nation under intolerable circumstances and in very little time and against the resistance of most of the country.
You mean the hope is not to simply move into white middle-class values, is that it?
Well, even if that were the hope, it isn't, as a matter of fact. But even if that were the hope, it would not be possible. It is simply not possible for the church, for example, to accept me into it without becoming a different institution. I'd have to be deluded not to realize that. And the church, of course, realizes it, which is why it isn't about to change. What applies to the church applies to politics, applies to every level of national life. In order to accommodate me, in order to overcome so many centuries of cruelty and bad faith and genocide and fear, simple fear, all the American institutions and all the American values, public and private, will have to change. The Democratic Party will have to become a different party, for example.
How do you envisage the result of this movement, if successful? What kind of a world do you envisage out of it?
Well, I envisage a world which is almost impossible to imagine in this country. But still, a world in which ultimately race would count for nothing, in which Americans simply, not so simply, would grow up enough to recognize that I don't threaten them. Part of the problem here has nothing to do with race at all. It has to do with ignorance. It has to do with the cult of youth.
Undoubtedly, that's true. Maybe hold that, though, for a moment. Mm-hmm. It's one of the points where other things intersect this.
Yes.
Some people say, like Oscar Handlin and other historians and sociologists, that equality increases rather than diminishes the tendency of ethnic groups to pull together, to define themselves as a group. That once the pressure of discrimination has been lessened or removed, history so far of America has been for the ethnic groups to coalesce rather than to dissolve.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that, and in any case, I'm very badly placed to answer it, since the American Negro has not experienced that particular transformation, you know, and And the ethnic group in this context can only really refer to the American Negro, because
in this
particular
case,
it can't really apply to the Irish, and not really finally to the Jew. But we're talking about the low man on the American totem pole, the man on whose labor this country, on whose free labor this country was built.
Now, what about this, though, in this connection? That's a question to speculate about for a moment. In the last few years, if we can believe the sales of bleaching creams and such things, and the avowed sentiments of many Negroes, there's a movement toward an acceptance of and a pride in Negro identity,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to an older tendency to shift from that center, not either by actual passing or by changing personality or appearance. This would seem to indicate something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, what I think it indicates is simply that for the first time in American Negro history, or in American history, the American black man has not been at the mercy of the American white man's image of him. This is because of Africa. America, because it has not been reached.
It clearly has not been reached, but the question of a tendency or a will is more defined.
I really think it comes out of the fact that for the first time in the memory of anybody living, there are African statesmen, the West was forced to deal with Africans on a level of power. And that the image of, you know, the shiftless darky and the all that jazz, which he lived so long, was shattered, and kids then, people, had another image to turn to, which released them. It's still, by the way, you know, after all, very romantic for an American Negro to think of himself as an African. But it's necessary. It's a necessary step in the recreation of his morale.
In the matter of discussed long ago by Du Bois and many other people since, of the possible split in the psyche of the American Negro, and you've written something mm-hmm. about along this mm-hmm. line, the tendency to identify with the African culture or African mystique or the mystique noir, or to enter even the American Negro culture as opposed to American white culture, mm-hmm. the tendency to pull in that direction, as opposed to the tendency to pull over and accept the Western European American white tradition as another pull. Mm-hmm. Are these two things against each other? Can be, anyway. Some people they are. Some people profess to be greatly troubled by this. Do you feel this question is real? Well, for yourself or in your observation?
Well, how do I answer that? In my own case, whatever that means. It was very hard for me to accept Western European values because they didn't accept me. It was any Negro born in this country spends a great deal of time trying to be accepted, trying to find a way to operate within the culture and not to be made to suffer so much by it, but nothing you do works, no matter how many showers you take, no matter what you do. These Western values simply absolutely resist and reject you. So that inevitably at some point, you know, you turn away from them. Or you re-examine them. I think first you turn away, then perhaps you re-examine them. Because it's something that slaves knew. And the masters haven't found it out yet, but the slaves who adopted that bloody cross did know one thing. They knew those masters could not be Christians because Christians couldn't have treated them that way. Do you know what I mean? This rejection has been at the very heart of the American Negro psyche from the beginning.
Let's take the African side of it. You have written on that along the way, covering that the conference in Paris,
a
piece about that. Shall I hold that while you like?
That's right.
That would imply a difficulty, what you have written there would imply a difficulty too in identifying with Africa.
One's got to be honest about that. It's not impossible, but at that point, certainly in my life, and I think for many people, and until now, it's hard because it's all been buried. It's hard, for Africans who only now are beginning to emerge from the long colonial night, So there's a sense in which you can say that the very word African, the very term, is European invention. I'm not at all convinced that people in the villages outside of the cities think of themselves as Africans. You know, and after all, it wasn't very long ago, the Italians didn't think of themselves as Italians.
It's not the horizon in the African village.
Not yet. You know, I think it would take, you know, a couple of generations. And in the case of an American Negro, Africa, you know, which part of Africa, which Africa would you be thinking of? Are you thinking of Senegal? Are you thinking of St. Louis? Are you thinking of Freetown? And if you are thinking of any of these places, what do you know about them? What is there that you can use? What is there that you can contribute to? These are very grave questions. I don't think that there's, you know, that the void is absolute, or that nothing, that no bridge can be made. But I think we've been away from Africa for 400 years. No power in heaven will allow me to find my way back. I can go back, and maybe even function there, but I have to be on terms which have yet to be worked out.
Richard Wright didn't find it very happy, did he?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think Richard went there with the wrong set of assumptions. But then, there's no way not to go there with the wrong set of assumptions. I did too, in a way, you know. But, not Richard's assumptions, but... I just didn't know what I would find. And what I found surprised me, and I must say, sort of gladdened me. But I still would not be able to tell you exactly what it was. And I still less be able to tell you what my own relationship to it is.
Do you remember what your assumptions were?
No, I guess I blocked them out. I remember before I went, I did my best to discard whatever assumptions I might have had. Though, of course, you never succeed in doing that. You know, I did realize, but I'd realized it before, you know, that I was in some way very European, because that was the way I'd been, that's what I'd been stained by, you know, that there were... And that also that I was a Puritan, in the sense that, in a very serious sense, in the sense that Africans are not, in the sense of being distrustful of the flesh and a celebration and of being afflicted with a totally Western kind of self-consciousness, which I will always have. I realized, too, that the reality of castration had been uppermost in my mind, as it has been in the minds of almost any American Negro male, since you realize, from the time I realized I was a male, and that this had done something to my psyche, no matter how I had adjusted myself to it or failed to adjust myself to it, it had been a reality for me in a way that it had not been, as far as I could tell, for them. There were a great many differences, but there were also great echoes, which were more troubling, and I didn't, because I found those harder to read.
Do you think the echoes came from actual cultural transmission or in some other way?
Is it blank?
Anyone know?
I just couldn't answer that. I saw girls on the streets of Freetown with their groceries on their heads and their babies on their backs who looked just like girls and walked just like girls on New Orleans Avenue. But I'm not capable of telling you what this means. But maybe I'll find out one day. I'm going back.
I've heard youngish Negroes from the North who have gone to Mississippi or Alabama to work in voter registration or such things, say that the salvation is in meeting the purity of expression, the purity of feeling, in some poor, half-literate, or cotton picker, you see, who has come awake to his manhood.
I would tend to agree with that.
This is the source of the real revelation.
I think I would really agree with that. I've seen in my own, you know, myself, some extraordinary people coming just coming out of some enormous darkness, and there is something indescribably moving and direct and heroic about those people. And that's where the hope in my mind lies, you know, much more than in, let's say, someone like me, who's, you know, much more, as it were, corrupted by the psychotic society in which we live.
This impulse that you have and these people that I was speaking of have is a very common one in many different circumstances, though, isn't it?
Yes, I know.
You'll find many white people, I use the word romanticized now without prejudice.
I know what you mean.
About some simpler form of life.
Actually, I don't think
say it's... Say the white hunter, you see, in the far west, or the American Indian, or even turns toward the Negro in that same romantic way.
Mm-hmm. Or the worker.
Or the worker. This is an impulse that many people who feel inner complications or live in a complicated world which they don't quite accept, don't want to accept, turn to some simpler form.
I'm not so sure it's simpler, though. That's my real reservation about it. I'm not convinced that some of those old ladies and old men I talk to down there I know they're not simple. They're far from simple. And what the emotional and psychological makeup is, which has allowed them to endure so long, is something of a mystery to me. They're no more simple, for example, than Medgar Evers was simple. You know, he was...
He was apparently certainly a different cut from,
Yeah, but Medgar, there's something very rustic about him and direct. But obviously he was far from a simple man. I think that it has something to do with, what one takes... I don't know, there's something to do with what one thinks the nature of reality is. And especially in this country now, it's very hard to read the riddle of the human personality because we have so little respect for it. And I think this complicates all our endeavors and all our relationships. But I don't... My own father, who was certainly something like those people, was very far from being a simple man. It was simply that I think that the nature of his complexity and the nature of the complexity of those field workers in the Deep South is such...
That would be called or thought of as more or less corresponding white types.
Yes, you might. Now, there I'm on very shaky ground. I'm not equipped to say yes or no, but
some
I would...
Some of the southern sharecroppers, white sharecroppers.
Except that I have the feeling that the difference between the southern white sharecropper and a black one, to speak in terms of, now to speak in, this is a generality, obviously. But still I suspect that the difference is in the nature of their relationship to their own pain. And I think the white southern sharecropper, in a general way, then would have a much harder time using his pain, using his sorrow, putting himself in touch with it, and using it to survive than a black one. And there's a level of melancholy and a level even tragic in Negro experience which is simply denied in white experience. And I think this makes a very great difference. A difference in authority, a difference in growth, a difference in possibility. The one thing that is not true of the Negro in this context, anyway, he is not forbidden, as all white Southerners are, to assess his own beginnings. He may find it, for one reason or another, impossible or dangerous or fatal to do so. But a white Southerner, I think, suffers from the fact that his childhood, his early youth, when his relationship to black people is very different than it becomes later, is sealed off from him. And he can never go back, he can never dig it up on pain of destruction, nearly. And I think this creates his torment and his paralysis.
Do you see any chance of an understanding between, say, the southern poor white and the poor southern Negro?
Well, too high. The depression have done nothing to create that, nothing to defeat that. Is the bargain struck by the Reconstruction, I suppose, which was to use the poor white, keep them almost under it, yes. And I don't know enough about that era, to discuss it in any detail, but I know to what you're referring. But my point in any case is that they didn't. And now the situation is more grim than ever. It would seem to me, to go back to what I said earlier, that part of the answer to that problem, that question, would really be to begin to break the power of a few men in the Democratic Party.
Some Negroes in Mississippi and Alabama hold out hope for this, for the understanding, for the rapprochement between the southern poor white, the sharecropper type, the laborer, and the poor Negro.
Well, I don't see much hope for it as things are now, because in the first place, the labor situation is too complex and too shaky. The white, all workers in this country are in terrible trouble.
Not enough jobs to go around.
That's right. And they're all vanishing. They're just such jobs as there are. And this does not make for good relations between workers, as we all know. I still insist on, you know, the fact that it really seems to me that if Mississippi could be released from Senator Eastland's grip, clutches, then there might be much more hope for the poor white, who in effect is kept in prison by men like him.
Let's switch for a moment to a matter of the general pattern of leadership in the Negro Revolution, or whatever we said along.
Yeah.
Almost always, I suppose always, in successful movements, mass movements in history, you find a tendency toward greater and greater centralization of leadership. Mm-hmm. The man. The bureau behind him, but the man. Is there a tendency in that direction now among Negroes, do you think? You see the centralization, this process going on?
No, I see a shaking down of something, but I don't see anything yet resembling what we can call a centralization, not according to me. Part of the problem is that the tactics of the old leadership have had to rely very heavily, you know, on the have been defined very heavily by the white power structure. Put it another way, the college president of, let's say, 40 years ago had to deal with the state governor and with the powers that be in a very different way than now, because the state is no longer able to do what it was able since the Supreme Court decision. Let me put it this way: the college president does not have to go to the state to get a college dormitory, because the state's building college dormitories as fast as they can to keep Negroes out of white schools. Now that changes, that alone changes, you know, the tactics and changes the whole picture. Furthermore, there have always been in this country two Negro leaders. One was one you called a leader, and one was mine, you know, the real one, who was always found a dick.
Well, we have, that's true. But taking things as of now, then I try to reinterpret what you said, and if I'm wrong, stop and correct me. The NAACP legal techniques are defined by the old system.
Yes, to a very large extent, they have to be.
Yes. Yeah. Well, as legal, they were establishing as a legal reference. Wouldn't they have had to work in terms of law?
Well, there's a limit even to that, you see, because some of the laws through which you had to work were unjust and unworkable.
Well, their effort was to change this.
I know, but the point is, indeed, and it's a very admirable effort. I'm not in any sense trying to condemn that. But still, it was very complex. And his enemy there was time. You know, time does pass, and a man has only one life to live. And it was inevitable that these techniques, if they were not, you know, swiftly successful, and they couldn't be, would have to fail before the weight of human impatience, which no one, after all, no one can possibly condemn. And what has happened now, it seems to me, is that for the first time in the history of this struggle, the poor Negro has hit the streets, really, and has changed the nature of the struggle completely, and according to...